Serving new thought brings new thought to your fingertips. Hello, welcome to a Divine Waves production sponsored by Serving New Thought. Visit www.spiritualresources.org to discover more wonderful digital resources that support you on your journey of empowerment. You will also find these works in text format, along with digital downloads of the audio, at www.newthoughtlibrary.com, with an increasing number of ebook downloads. These digital recordings are part of an ongoing series empowering people around the world with high-quality readings of seminal New Thought classics. Special thanks to the Mana Group of Florida for their wonderful support to purchase equipment. Now, we present Thomas Troward's The Law and the Word, read by Dr. Michael Spottiswood, the voice of Thomas Troward.
Chapter 7, Death and Immortality. I think most of my readers will agree with me that the greatest of all promises is that of the overcoming of death. For as the greater includes the lesser, the power which can do that can do anything else. We think that there are only two things that are certain in this world, death and taxes, and no doubt under the ordinary past conditions this is quite true. But the question is, are they really inherent in the essential nature of things, or are they not the outcome of our past limited and often inverted modes of thought? The teaching of the Bible is that they are the latter. On the subject of taxes, the Master says, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's," Matthew chapter 22, verse 21. But on another occasion he said that the children of the king were not liable to taxation, Matthew chapter 17, verse 26. However, we may leave the taxes alone for the present, with a remark that their resemblance to death consists in both being, under present conditions, regarded as compulsory. Under other conditions, however, we can well imagine taxes disappearing into a unity of thought, which would merge them into cooperation and voluntary contribution. And it appears to me quite possible for death to disappear in like manner. In whatever way we may interpret the story of Eden, whether literally or, if like some fathers of the church such as Origen, we take it as an allegory, the result is the same, that death is not in the essence of man's creation, but supervened as the consequence of an inverted mode of thought. The creative spirit thought one way, and Eve thought another, and since the thought of the creating spirit is the origin of life, this difference of opinion naturally resulted in death. Then from this starting point, all the rest of the Bible is devoted to getting rid of this difference of opinion between us and the spirit of life, and showing us that the spirit's opinion is truer than ours, and so leading us to adopt it as our own. The whole thing turns on the obvious proposition that if you invert the cause, you also invert the effect. It is the principle that division is the inversion of multiplication. So that if 2 times 2 equals 4, then you cannot escape the consequence that 4 divided by 2 equals 2. The question then is, which of the two opinions is the more reasonable, that death is essentially inherent in the nature of things, or that it is not? Probably 99 out of 100 readers will say that the whole experience of mankind from the earliest ages proved that death is the unchangeable law of the universe, and that there have been no exceptions. I am not quite sure that I would altogether agree with them on this last point. But putting that aside, let us consider whether it really is the essential law of the universe. To say that it is proved by past experience of the race is what logicians call a petitio principi. It is assuming the whole point at issue. It is the same argument which our great-grandfathers would have used against aerial navigation. No one had ever travelled in the air, and that proved that no one ever could. My father, who was a junior officer in India when the first railway was run in England, used to tell a story of one of his senior officers who, on being asked what he thought of the rapidity of the new mode of travelling, said he thought it was all a damn lie. Which opinion appeared to him to settle the whole question. but I hope that none of my readers will hold the same opinion regarding the overcoming of death, even though they might express it in more polite language. At any rate, it may be worthwhile to examine the theoretical possibility of the idea. To begin with, it involves a self-contradiction to say that the energy of any force can stop the working of that force. If a force stops working, it is for one of two reasons: either that the supply of it is exhausted, or that it is overcome by an opposite and neutralizing force. But we have seen that the originating cause of all things can only be an inexhaustible power of life, and therefore the hypothesis of it becoming exhausted is eliminated. And similarly, since all the forces of the universe proceed from this source, it is impossible for any of them to have a nature diametrically opposite to that of the source from which they flow. So the alternative must be eliminated also. Accordingly, the outflow, undifferentiated, of life energy from the eternal substantive of spirit is never stopped by its own current in any of its differentiated streams. It is impossible for a current to be stopped by its own flow, whether it be a current of electricity, steam, water, or anything else. What then does stop the flow of any sort of current? It is the resistance or inertia of the channel through which it flows. So that we come back to the formula of Ohm's law, C equals E over R, as a general proposition applicable to any conceivable sort of energy. The neutralizing power, then, is not that of the flowing of any sort of energy, but the rigidity or inertia of the medium through which the energy has to make its way, thus bringing us back to Ruach and Hoshech, the expansive and compressive principles in the opening verses of Genesis. It is the broad scientific generalization of the opposition between ertia, or energy, and inertia, or absence of energy. And since, for the reasons just given, ertia cannot go against itself, the only thing that can stop it is inertia. Now, the components of the human body are simply various chemical elements, so much carbon, so much hydrogen, etc., as any textbook on the subject will tell you. And though, of course, every sort of substance is the abode of ceaseless atomic energy, we all recognize that merely atomic energy is not that of the power of thought, will, and perception, which makes us organized mentalities instead of mere aggregations of the various substances exposed to view in a biological museum as constituting the human body. You might take all these substances in their proper proportions and shake them up together, but you would not make an intelligent man of them. We are therefore safe in saying that the physiological body represents the principle of inertia in us, while the something that thinks in us represents the principle of ertia. The balance of power between the life principle in us and the death principle is then necessarily a question of the balance between these two, the spirit and the flesh, or ertia and inertia. Why, then, does the balance preponderate to the life side for a certain length of time and then go over to the opposite side? Now this brings us to the distinction which the old writers drew between the vital soul of any living thing and the spirit. Their conception of the vital soul was very much the same as I have set forth in the chapter on the soul of the subject. It is the individual's particular share of the cosmic soul, or anima mundi, whether it be of an individual tree or an individual person, and the ordinary maximum length of time during which the vital soul will be able to overcome the inertia of its physical vehicle depends upon the particular class to which the individual belongs. What the ordinary maximum is in regard to any species is a matter of experience, and it is in this way that we have fixed the usual limit of human life at 80 years. Now it is here that we shall begin to profit by some knowledge about the invisible part of ourselves. The actual molecules of our body, as I have just said, are only so much dead matter. This inert material is pulled about in various directions by strings which we call muscles, according to the movements we wish our bodies to make. And these muscles are set in motion by the vibrations of the nerves. But what is it that occasions these vibrations of the nerves? Here we begin to pass beyond the limits of official science, though not beyond the limits of recognizable law. We have to recognize the existence of an etheric body acting as an intermediary between the intention, desire, or, in the case of human beings, thought of the soul, and the physical vibrations of the nerves. This is why, in an earlier chapter, I have drawn attention to our power of sending out etheric vibrations beyond the limits of the physical body, as in the case of Dorochard's experiments. Such experiments show that there is, in us, something not composed of dense matter. And it is this something that we speak of as the etheric body. But if we wish to trace the links by which our thought operates upon the physical body, we find ourselves compelled to postulate yet another intermediary, what I have spoken of as the vital soul, a vehicle which does not consciously think, but in which what we may call race consciousness becomes centered in the individual. This race consciousness is none other than the ever-present will to live, which is the basis of physical evolution, that automatically acting principle which causes plants to turn towards the sun, animals to seek their proper food, and both animals and men to try instantly to escape from immediate danger. It is what we call instinct, which does not reason. I may give a laughable experience of my own to illustrate the fact that conscious reason is not the method of this faculty. Once, when on leave in India, I was walking along a street in London in the heat of a summer's day, and suddenly noticed, just at my feet, a long dark thing apparently wiggling across the white glare of the pavement. "Snake!" I exclaimed, and jumped aside for all I was worth. And the next moment I was laughing at myself for not recollecting that cobras were not common objects in the streets of London. But it looked just like one, and of course turned out to be nothing but a piece of rag. Well, instinct did its duty, even if it did make a fool of me. But there is certainly no conscious reasoning in the matter. Only automatic action of the inherent law, self-preservation, is the first law of nature. The vital soul, then, is the seat of all those instincts which go towards the preservation of the individual's physical body, and towards the propagation of the race. And it is on this account that our theosophical friends call it the desire body, or, to use the Indian term, kama-rupa. It acts with conscious intention, but not with conscious reasoning. It is thus distinguished, on the one hand, from the etheric body, which is a mere vehicle for the finer vibrations that can take place in the denser matter of the physical body, but which has no intention, and on the other hand, from the mind, which acts by conscious reasoning, and it thus forms an intermediary between the two. The importance of recognizing the place of this higher intermediary in the ascending scale of living principle is that for all practical purposes, the animal world does not rise higher than this in the scale. It is true that in particular instances we find the first dawning of the mental faculty in an animal, but it is only very faint. So this does not affect the broad general principle. The point to be noted is that up to this stage human beings are built on the same lines as animals, and what distinguishes us is the addition in ourselves of a higher factor, namely that of the reasoning mind exercising the power of conscious thought. Now it is the direction of this thought that influences the three lower factors. The sequence going upwards is as follows. Movement is communicated to the physical body by the etheric body, and movement is communicated to the etheric body by the vital soul. Then, in proportion as the purely instinctive action of the vital soul is controlled by the conscious thought, so its action upon the two lower principles is modified. Here, then, is the crucial point. In what direction is the conscious thought going to modify the action of the three principles that are below it? If it takes the soul of mere racial desire and the physical body as its standard of thought, then it naturally follows that it cannot raise it any higher. It has descended to their level and so cannot pour any stream of life into it, on the simple principle that no current can flow from a lower to a higher level, whether the difference in level be that of actual elevation, as in the case of water, or difference in potential, as in the case of electricity. On the other hand, if the conscious mind recognizes that it itself proceeds from some higher source, and its thought is modified accordingly, then it, in its turn, reacts correspondingly on the lower principles. If this is clear to the student, he will see how it is that by limiting our conception to the ideas currently entertained by the race, we impress these ideas on our three lower principles. It is true that these three principles are not capable of reasoning themselves, but the highest of them, the vital soul, has its action modified by the reasoning principle above it, and so communicates to the two lower principles corresponding waves of vibration. And in this connection, we must remember the distinction between the two systems of nerves. The voluntary system, connected with the brain and forming the medium of all voluntary action, and the involuntary or sympathetic system, connected with the solar plexus and controlling all the automatic actions of the body, and thus being the agent of that continual renewal of the physical organism which begins to disintegrate immediately the soul has left it.
You're listening to Thomas Troward's The Law and the Word, read by Dr. Michael Spottiswood. Audio downloads of this and other wonderful New Thought classics are available through www.divinewaves.com, and the books are available for study along with audio downloads at www.newthoughtlibrary.com.
Now it is through this inner builder of the body that our thought reacts upon our physical organism. The response is purely automatic, for the simple reason that there is no original thinking power in the three lower principles. The action is that of the law directed by thought or word. In this way, then, it appears to me, the personal in us acts upon the impersonal in us. And if we assume, as I think we may, that this action takes place by means of etheric waves, we have, on general scientific principles, a clue to what we read in the Bible about the transmutation of the body. The theory of the constitution of the atom shows us that its nature is determined by the number of particles and their rate of revolution, and that a change in the rate of revolution results in the throwing off of some of those particles. Then, the number of particles being altered, there results a change in the distribution of the positive and negative charges within the sphere of the atom, since they must always exactly balance one another. And this change in the distribution of the positive and negative charges must instantly result in a corresponding change in the geometrical configuration of particles constituting the atom. That the particles automatically arrange themselves into groups of different geometrical form within the sphere of the atom has been demonstrated both mathematically and experimentally by Professor Sir J.J. Thomson. These geometrical forms resulting, of course, from the balance of attraction and repulsion between the positive and negative charges of the particles. That transmutation of one substance into another is not a mere dream of the medieval alchemist is now already shown by modern science. Under suitable conditions, an atom of radium breaks down into atoms of another sort known as radium emanations, and these again break down into yet another sort of atoms to which the name of radium emanations X has been given, while radium emanation also gives rise to an atom of helium. Thorium also behaves in a similar manner, transmuting into atoms called thorium X, which again change into atoms of another sort to which the name of thorium emanations has been given, and these in turn transmute into atoms of yet another kind, known as thorium emanations X. The same is the case with uranium, which, however, so far as is yet known, undergoes only one transformation into what is known as uranium X. The transmutation of one sort of atom into another is, therefore, not a visionary fancy, but an established fact. And although our laboratory experiments in this direction may not as yet have gone very far, they have gone far enough to show that a law of transmutation does exist in nature. Then, since the difference between one sort of atom and another results from the difference and arrangement of their particles, and the difference in the number and arrangement of the particles results from the difference in the speed of their rotation, and this again results from the difference in the energy or rate of vibration of the particles, we come back to the different rates of etheric vibrations as the commencement of the whole series of changes. And as is proved by the facts of wireless telephoning, different rates of etheric vibrations can be set in motion by varying the sounds of the human voice, even on the physical plane. May it not be, then, that by the same law, vibrations of other wavelengths yet unknown to science will be set into motion by the unspoken word of our thought? The substance known as polonium, even by its near approach to an electric bell, causes it to ring. And if etheric waves can thus be started by an inanimate substance, why should we suppose that our thought has less power, especially when metaphysically we cannot avoid the conclusion that the whole creation must have its origin in the divine thought? From such considerations as these, I think we may reasonably infer that if the mind be illumined by a range of thought coming from a higher mind, there is no limit to the power which may thus be exercised over the material world, and that therefore St. Paul's statement regarding the transmutation of the present physical body is one which should be included in the circle of our ideas as being within the scope of the laws of the universe when their action is specialized by the power of the Word, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and similarly with regard to other statements to the same effect contained in the Bible. What is wanted is the realization of a greater word than that which we form from the current experience of the race. The race has formed its word on the basis of the lower principles of our being, and if we are to advance beyond this, the law of the subject clearly indicates that it can only be by adopting a more fundamental word or idea than that which we have hitherto thought to include in the entire range of possibilities. The law of our further evolution demands a word not formed from past experiences, but based on the eternal principle of the all-originating life itself. And this is in strict accord with scientific method. If we had always allowed ourselves to be ruled by past experiences, we should still be primitive savages. And it is only by the gradual perception of underlying principles that we have attained the degree of civilization we have reached today. So what the Bible puts before us is simply the application to life in ourselves of the maxim that principle is not limited by precedent. Now the Bible promises serve to put us on the track of this principle. They suggest lines of inquiry. And the inquiry leads to the conclusion that the two ultimate factors are the law and the word. What we have missed hitherto is the conception of the limitless possibilities of the law and the limitless power of the word. On one occasion the Master said to the Jews, "Ye know not the scriptures, neither the power of God." Matthew chapter 22, verse 29. And the same is the case with ourselves. The true scripture is the scriptura rerum, or the law indelibly written in the nature of things. And the written scriptures are true only because they contain the statement of the principle of the law. Therefore, until we see the principle of the law, we know not the scriptures. On the other hand, until we see the principle of the operation of the word through the law, we do not know the power of God. And it is only as we come to perceive the interaction of the law and the word that we see the beginning of the way that leads to life and liberty. But although it is evident from the text just quoted, as well as from other intimations in his epistles, that St. Paul fully grasped the principle of the transmutation of the body, he himself tells us that he has not yet attained to the resurrection from the dead, but is still pressing on towards its attainment. Philippians chapter 3, verse 12. and it is to be remarked that he is not here speaking of a general resurrection of the dead, but as the word exanastasis in the original Greek indicates, as a special resurrection from among the dead. This indicates an individual achievement, not merely something common to the whole race. From this and other passages, it is evident that by the dead, it means those whose conception of life is limited to the four lower principles, thus unifying the mind with the three principles which are below it. And the same idea is expressed in a variety of ways all through the Bible. This therefore shows that he is quite aware that knowledge of the principle does not enable us there and then to attain the completeness of the application. And if this be the case with St. Paul, we cannot be surprised to find that it is the same with ourselves. But on the other hand, knowledge of the principle is the first step towards getting it to work. Well, St. Paul is dead and buried, and so, I suppose, will most of us be in a few years. So the question confronts us, what becomes of us then? As Milton puts it in Il Penseroso, we want to unsphere the spirit of Plato, and unfold what worlds or what vast regions hold the immortal mind that hath forsook her mansion in the fleshly nook. Yes, this is a question of deep personal interest to us, but as I cannot speak from experience, I will restrict myself to seeing whether we can form any sort of general hypothesis on the basis of the principles we have recognized. What then is likely to survive? The physical body is, of course, disintegrated by the chemistry of nature. The etheric body continues to retain its form longer because it is a condensation of etheric particles wrought together by the etheric waves sent out by the vital soul and is therefore not subject to the laws of chemical affinity. The vital soul, being the race principle of life in the individual, that principle which automatically seeks to preserve the individual from disintegration, probably survives longer still until, ceasing to receive any reflex vibrations from the body, it grows gradually weaker in its sense of individual guardianship, and so is eventually absorbed into the group soul, or generic essence of the class to which it belongs. This is probably what happens in the case of animals for want of any higher vivifying principle, and would be the same for us were it not for the fact of having such a higher principle. In our case, I should imagine that the influx of etheric waves received from the thought action of the mind would have the effect of continuing to impress the vital soul with a sense of individuality in terms of its own plane, which would prevent it from being absorbed into the group soul so long as the vital current from the mind continued to reach it. But eventually that current would cease to reach it, in some cases because the individual mind that governed it would gradually realize that its connection with the physical plane had ceased, and in others because, through a higher illumination, the mind had of its own volition turned its thoughts in another direction. In either case, on the ceasing of that vital current, the vital soul of the human being would likewise be absorbed into the cosmic soul, or anima mundi. How long the process of disintegration of the etheric body and absorption of the vital soul may take is a question on which I can offer no opinion, beyond saying that certain psychic phenomena suggest that in some cases it may take a very long period of time. But for the reasons I have now given, it appears to me that the permanently surviving factor is the thinking mind, which is our real self, and is positively our center of consciousness after the physical body has been put off. By the facts of the case, its consciousness is no longer affected by vibrations received from the physical body, and therefore to the extent to which our idea of life has been centered in that body, we shall feel its loss. If our motto has been, "Let us eat, drink, for tomorrow we die," we shall feel very dead indeed. A living death, a consciousness of being cut off from all that constituted our enjoyment of life, a thirst for the satisfaction of our customary ideas, which we have no power to quench. And in proportion as our habitual mode of thought is raised above that lowest level, so will our sense of loss be less. Then, by the same law, if our habitual mode of thought is turned towards pure, beautiful, and helpful ideals, we shall feel no loss at all, for we shall carry our own ideals with us, and, I hope, see them more clearly, by reason of their disentanglement from mundane considerations. In what precise way we may then be able to work out our ideals, I will not now stop to discuss. What we want first is a reasonable theory, based upon the principle of that universal law which is only varied in its actions by the conditions under which it works. So, instead of speculating as to precise details, we may generalize the question of how we can work out the good ideals which we carry over with us, and put it in this way. Our ideas are embodied in thoughts. Thoughts start trains of etheric waves, which waves induce a reciprocal action whenever they meet with a receiver capable of vibrating synchronously with them. And so eventually the thought becomes a fact, and our helpful and beautiful ideal becomes a work of power, whether in this world or any other. Now it is to the forming of such ideals that the Bible, from first to last, is trying to lead us. From first to last, it is working upon one uniform principle, that the thought is the word, that the word sets the law in motion, and that when the law is set in motion, it acts with mathematical precision. The Bible is a handbook of instruction for the use of our creative power of thought, and this is the sequence which it follows. One definite method, so fundamental in its nature that it applies equally to the making of a packing case or the making of a solar system. Now that we have formed a generalized conception based upon this universal method of the sort of consciousness we are likely to have when we pass out of the physical body, then our thought naturally passes on to the question, what will happen after this? It is here that some theory of the reconstitution of the physical body appears to me to hold a most important place in the order of our evolution. Let us try to trace it out on the general lines of the creative power of thought indicated above, the keynote to which is that the law is specialized by the word and cannot of itself bring out the infinite possibilities contained in it without such specializing, just as in all scientific developments of ordinary life. The clue to the whole question is that our place in the universal order is to develop the infinite resources of the original life and substance into actual facts. Nature, unaided, fails. The personal factor must cooperate with the impersonal, alike for the setting up of an electric bell, or for the furtherance of cosmic evolution. And the reason it is so is because it could not possibly be otherwise. If we now start to recognize this as our necessary place in the progressive order of the universe, I think it will help us to form a reasonable theory as to the reconstruction of the body. First of all, why have we any physical body at all? As a matter of fact, we do have one. No amount of transcendental philosophizing will alter the fact, and so we may conclude that there is some reason for it. We have seen the truth of the maxim omne vivum ex vivo, and therefore all particular forms of life are differentiations of the one basic life. This means a localizing of the life principle in individual centers. The formation of a center implies condensation, for where there is no condensation, the energy, whether electricity or life, is simply dispersed and achieving no purpose. Therefore, distinctiveness from the undifferentiated original life is a necessity of the case. Consequently, the higher the degree of consciousness of individuality, the greater must be the consciousness of distinctness of personality. We say of a wobbly sort of person, that fellow is no use, you can't depend on him. We say of a person whose ideas, intentions, and methods are subject to continual variations under all sorts of outside influences, whether of opinions or circumstances, that he has no backbone, meaning that he is want of individuality. He has no real thought of his own, and so has no word of power by which to cooperate with the law. Therefore, to the extent to which this is the case with any of us, we are of no use in furthering the unfoldment of evolution, whether in ourselves or anywhere else. Now, we talk a lot about evolution or the unfolding, but we seem often not to realize that there must be something to unfold, and that therefore involution or the concentration of the life principle must be a condition precedent to its evolution. This process of involution must therefore be a process of gradually increasing concentration of the life principle by association with denser and denser modes of the universal substance. Then, on the principle of vibration, the less dense the substance in which the life is immersed, the more it must be subject to being stirred by vibratory currents other than those produced by the conscious action of the ego or inherent life of the individual that is being formed. But the sum of vibrations in anything determines the mode, power, and direction of its action. Therefore, the less the ego be concentrated through association with a dense vehicle, the more wobbly it must be, and consequently the less able to take any effective part in the further work of creation. But in proportion as the ego builds up an individual will, the more it gets out of the wobbly state. Or to refer once more to the idea of etheric waves, it becomes able to select what vibrations it will receive and what vibrations it will send out.
We trust you are enjoying this Divine Waves production of Thomas Troward's The Law and the Word. Please consider supporting our efforts to bring you additional New Thought classics in audio format. Contributions can be made at www.servingnewthought.org/donations.htm.